Let's start off with a statistic. Olivia, give us a statistic.
One that I think is really telling is that four companies control nearly 85% of the U.S. beef market.
Wow. In the United States.
In the United States.
And where did you get that statistic?
I got it from a speech that Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren gave at the end of June about corporate concentration. And it was really more incisive and definite than any I've heard from a contemporary politician, and one that I think has become and is something of a battle cry for a resurgent antitrust movement.
And it got a lot of attention, and that's why we're going to start talking about that first thing here in our year roundup Building Local Power podcast. So we had Olivia kicking it off there. You heard her voice with the community-scaled economy. She's been a veteran of past podcasts from Building Local Power, our series. I'm Chris Mitchell. I do broadband type stuff for the Institute. We also have Carly with our energy initiative.
Hello, Chris.
And Nick, who does a lot of communications work for us.
Hi, good to be here, Chris.
All right, so now you know everyone's voice, and we can go back to Senator Warren. I thought that speech was really interesting and powerful, and to me, it was a sign that 2016 was a year in which more concern was building about the role of monopoly. We think we saw that in the election, where Bernie Sanders certainly spoke out against monopoly. We saw it in which Donald Trump would occasionally tweet against corporate power, although nothing in his presidential elect sort of status suggests he's going to do anything about it. But anyway, that's something that I thought. Let me just throw it open to anyone else that wants to comment on her speech.
Something we talk about a lot here at ILSR is how corporate power is at the root of so many of the issues that we're working on. In our independent business program where I work, we talk about how having a strong middle class of entrepreneurs and proprietors gets undercut when you have Amazon waging predatory pricing wars on businesses it sees as competitors. Or in the energy program, how it's harder for people to recapture more of their energy dollar when you have an investor-owned utility monopoly defining the rules. But I think it can be hard to connect the dots between these colossal companies and the issues that we all see in our lives and communities. And Elizabeth Warren in this speech does that really well. And there's a particular chunk in the middle that I wanted to read. And she says, "Left unchecked, concentration will destroy innovation. Left unchecked, concentration will destroy more small companies and startups. Left unchecked, concentration will suck the last vestiges of economic security out of the middle class. Left unchecked, concentration will pervert our democracy into one more rigged game. But the good news is this isn't the first time America has faced this threat. We have been here before, and we know the way out." And then she goes back and talks about the first antitrust movement and the laws that produced that are still on the books. And there's something really hopeful.
You
said
the
that.
First antitrust movement. I just imagine Jesus wandering back into the temple on the donkey. You know, the first antitrust movement of the last 100 years, maybe. But of course, this is something that goes way back.
Yes,
can proverbially flip tables.
Right. Right. Exactly. Well, I think there might need to be some table flipping.
Yeah.
So
I think a lot of the things that Olivia is talking about too, I can be a little spokesman for our waste initiative too. You look at Waste Management Incorporated, and you know, destroying innovation is something you mentioned, and there's no incentive for them to change their model. And there, you see a lot of recycling rates go down when Waste Management wins contracts in local communities and as well as huge cities too. And a lot of the work that we've done in the past year, at least one of our co-founders, Neil Seldman, he wrote a response to the Waste Management CEO basically saying, there's no incentive for us as a company, for our stakeholders to do recycling. And he points out, that means you are writing off a number of economic development issues and a number of jobs that can be had in those communities that just aren't the purview of that corporation. And so it's really telling that there's that kind of divide and that stratification.
And I think, Nick, what you're talking about very closely aligns with what we see in the monopolistic electric utility landscape in this country right now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what we're going to be turning to in a minute. I want to make sure we don't just move on too quickly. But that's going to be our second topic, which is, I think, fascinating, which is a monopoly that seems to be being torn down. But on Senator Warren, I guess I'm just curious, Olivia, if we have a final thought on this. Do you have a sense of what you might think we'll see in 2017 on monopoly power?
I think right now there's so much that seems so uncertain. I think in the aftermath of the speech from Senator Warren, it really did become a more central thread in the campaign. Just the next month in July, antitrust was included in the Democratic Party platform for the first time in almost three decades. And in October, Hillary Clinton gave an economic policy speech in Ohio that was vigorous in her approach toward antitrust as well. And it certainly is something that we've started to see from the right, too. So
I was just going to ask you, isn't Sherrod Brown rather anti-monopoly? I'm curious because one of the things we've seen with anti-monopoly movements is that they tend to be both right and left, right? It's not one party. It's kind of half of each party working together.
Right, absolutely. I know Utah Senator Mike Lee has talked more about the need for antitrust oversight. Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley has talked about concentration in the food industry. So I do think that it's a bipartisan issue and that it, you know, is something to watch in 2017.
It doesn't seem to be equally bipartisan, though. I mean, this is something where I do think we need much more organization among the Republican side against monopoly. And that's, you know, I may not be as aware of it, but I think it's easier to think of people on the left that are more anti-monopoly right now than people on the right.
A large part of it could be having those conversations across the aisle, even though that sounds a little cliche. Getting people like Senator Warren, Senator Brown, Senator Grassley, getting them to talk to each other about these types of things, find the common ground. You only need 51 votes to pass something in the Senate, and the House is a much different story with the situation, but it seems like there is a real opportunity to work across the aisle with these things.
Let's move on to, Carl, you brought in the subject of something that I think is really interesting, which is the undermining of the historic monopoly status of the grid, basically.
Right. I think what's happening is that more people are becoming more aware of the economic benefits of a more diverse power system. So that means distributed generation like rooftop solar. That means renewable generation. That is maybe better for our environment long term, but also just makes economic sense. So that's drawing in sort of a broader range of stakeholders who are really interested in seeing something different from our utilities and from our communities.
When you say it makes economic sense, I think standard claim is that we can't afford rooftop solar, that is too expensive. So what do you mean?
Right. Well, there are utilities that are quite intransigent when it comes to this issue that are advocating for policies and implementing policies that make it tougher for individual households, businesses, their customers to pursue that as an alternative. But the fact is the cost of materials is going way down and that drives the upside up for people who are interested in pursuing distributed generation. So where the roadblock primarily exists right now is with these utilities that are sort of with white knuckles holding on to the power that they have historically had and digging in their heels when it comes to reconfiguring their business model in a way that makes more sense moving forward given the changes that are happening quickly in our marketplace.
One of the things that's I don't know how to describe it, but it's something that I think about all the time and I think is almost always disregarded by people, which is time, right? And that's the thing is that we look at how much does it cost to build solar today versus how much does it cost to build a coal plant today.
Right.
But these are things that are going to be operating for 50, 75 years. And so the question is, what will it cost to operate it over the lifetime, right? And one of the things I think that our colleague John Farrell talks about a lot is just that when you look at it that way, well, it might be more expensive for the first 5 years or 10 years. It might not be, but it might be. But over the next 50 years, coal is going to be insanely expensive because it's destroying the atmosphere.
Absolutely. And we have to consider other externalities like increased regulation and health concerns and things like that that are also going to affect the cost effectiveness and just the general effectiveness of traditional power sources like coal.
So what happened in 2016 that you'd really like to focus on in this discussion?
Well, I think one thing that is important to note in 2016, and I'm sure will continue into the new year, is that utilities are continuing to be very steadfast in hanging on to their outdated business models, which have enriched them over the last 100 years.
I just want to interrupt you for a second. This is true not just of the investor-owned utilities, the big ones, but also some of the munis and some of the co-ops, right? I mean, there's actually kind of a mix, I think, across utilities where we can't say all the munis are good guys and all of the IOUs are bad guys, right? There's kind of a mix of people who get it and people who don't get it.
There's a definite spectrum, but I think what we can say is that across the board, there's plenty of room for improvement.
Okay.
So one example that I think really illustrates utilities' unwillingness to accommodate changing market dynamics happened in Florida, and they really doubled down on their efforts to undermine the value of rooftop solar. In other states, there have been numerous cases, more than I can count, of utilities imposing greater fees for rooftop solar, you know, just trying to sort of skew that cost calculus in a way that makes it not financially feasible for people to do. But in Florida, a utility-backed coalition sunk millions and millions of dollars into a campaign to restrict access to the benefits of rooftop solar through a constitutional amendment. So this is sort of the biggest of the big when it comes to these campaigns to really undermine progress in this regard.
And really aggravating. I mean, you know, I think this is something Nick and I have talked about in the past. I think there's times you amend your constitution and there's times you don't, right? This is not a good, just even ignoring the policy and the stupidity of trying to restrict rooftop solar, you don't put it in the constitution, right?
Right, and get a load of this. They dubiously referred to this amendment as the rights of electricity customers regarding solar energy choice, which a consultant that had been working with the utility coalition backing this amendment admitted was political jujitsu. That's what he called it. And the tape was leaked, and I think the media carried that very far, and I think that had a lot to do with voters ultimately striking down this amendment in November. But it's a very scary thought that these very cash-rich organizations can come together and push something as destructive as this.
One of the things that I just want to make sure that we talk about a little bit is that I think 10 years ago, if you look back, I think it was the libertarians and people on the right that were really pushing to deregulate the electric system. And if you had told me then that ILSR would be a strong proponent of getting rid of the monopoly, of effectively deregulating to some extent, although we still want good rules in place, but the scope of those rules is changing significantly, I would have been very surprised. And so if we could just talk very briefly, why is it smart to disrupt the utility model to build local power?
I think because, well, fundamentally, as we all know and as we talk about often here, competition is good. And as distributed generation, due to the falling costs of materials and due to other incentives and policies, is put in closer reach for more people, there is a real opportunity to reshape the space to better serve communities and generate benefits that just simply didn't exist before. So I think that is sort of the key to remember here. And also, utilities are proving, as they showed in Florida again and again, that they cannot be trusted to accommodate this new value potential that we're seeing across the country when it comes to energy. So I think it's important for us to be vigilant and to really recognize what's going on and who's in control here.
There's been a lot of evidence about microgrids as supporting community safety. And in Hurricane Sandy, in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, a lot of New England communities have looked into implementing microgrids, and a lot of them maybe have run into barriers because of the electric utility, and, you know, being able to reformat what they're doing isn't in the electric utility's interest. So that's another big opportunity.
I also want to underline what Carly said about competition and how across our initiatives at ILSR, it's something that we talk about. And there was a part of this same speech from Elizabeth Warren where she said, you know, she's not approaching this issue because she's anti-business. She's approaching this issue because she really cares about markets. Her background is in contract law. And what markets need to work is open access and competition.
Right. I think that's important because as we talk about competition, it's important that you know, it's not about just letting whatever happens happen. It's about the role of policy in terms of making sure competition can thrive, right? And that you don't have a single firm that's able to disrupt everything. And I think that's different because we use the same term that some on the more the right side, the libertarian right, will use. But when they say competition, they don't really mean making sure there's a certain number of firms. They mean whatever happens, happens. And if one monopoly forms, well, then magically it will be cast down. And I think that is true. No monopoly will live forever. But, you know, it's like the classic line from Keynes, which is that in the long run, we're all dead. So, you know, I don't want to be stuck with a monopoly knowing that maybe my kids won't be stuck with that monopoly. We want to find ways of having a real choice in the market, and also where there may not be a possibility of a choice in broadband access, where it's just, you know, we're finding it's really hard to have the private sector solve this problem alone. Then we need to be more creative. So anyway, Nick, you have some stuff related to citizens voting as well that you wanted to talk about today.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this cuts across a lot of our initiatives. You know, you're looking at the energy initiative, our broadband initiative. There are lots of examples of local communities and states, citizen groups, all these different organizations, basically looking at Washington and saying they're not making policy that is actually affecting our community in a positive way. So we're going to take it in our own hands. And maybe I'll just start with what happened on election night for a number of states. In Arizona, Colorado, and Maine, you saw an increase of the minimum wage to $12 an hour. And then in Washington, an increase to $13.50 for the statewide level. You also saw in Arizona and Washington, sick leave measures were enacted to ensure that workers had mandated sick time. And, I mean, it's a good example of citizens looking and seeing their state governments, you know, whether that's in places like Arizona, where there's been a lot of difficulties in the state legislature and fights for certain measures, or you're looking at national policy that's just not there, doesn't exist, and citizens are saying, we want this, we want these types of measures, and just putting that on the table.
You know, I just wanted to point out with the sick leave, this is one of those discussions that I find interesting, and I actually care a lot about. Because I think it's one of, it gets back to this, what we just talked about, whether the market's working or not. If you're a local restaurant and you decide that you're going to give your employees sick time, your customers aren't going to know about that, right? Like the markets don't work so well in terms of spreading information that people are going to be like, I'm going to go eat at that restaurant because I know that their workers are going to be healthy and I'm not going to get ill from them because they're coming into work while they're ill because they can't possibly miss a paycheck, right? So you have a city that then says, well, we're going to require that everyone offers sick time. And I think that can be a smart approach. Then you have the chambers of commerce, which would tend to be dominated by the largest firms that have the worst wages and the worst benefits, fighting back against that. But I think the thing that we want to focus on is where cities want to have these sorts of requirements, we should encourage them to be able to make those rules and also recognize that it's actually good because then a local business that wants to act in a responsible manner will basically not be penalized, right? And I think that's important because that's what's important for minimum wage and other things is that you have local businesses that want to do the right thing. Then they are not penalized relative to their rivals in the market who may not want to do the right thing.
And that's an important point to make. I think what we see with a lot of these initiatives, and I'll get into some of the energy things as well, you see this as fundamentally in the invisible parts of how our system works. These aren't saying we are going to form a committee to do this. This is saying we want to mandate sick leave pay. We want to increase a minimum wage. And you're right, the patrons of a restaurant won't see that. If you look at Colorado, where there's been a number of initiatives enacted to limit fracking and limit siting of natural gas plants, that's not something that a lot of communities are saying, we're going to go out and do this ourselves. We want to limit the ability and we want to be able to control our local economy in a new way.
And I actually, and this is one of the things that I think that we'll all see, it's something we're all paying attention to, is that we're going to increasingly see states, especially Republican states, really limiting local authority to do these sorts of things. And I don't know, you know, Carly, Olivia, if you've seen some of that or if you have any expectations of where we're going to see these local initiatives running into state legislatures that are going to try and say, no, cities do not have the right to do that.
I think that's going to continue to be a dynamic that plays out across the economy. I think we can expect to see that happening in energy. I think we can expect to see that happening with small businesses. I think we can expect to see that happening with the workers' rights issues that Nick was outlining. I think this is going to be a dynamic that is maybe even thrust into a brighter spotlight given the political climate that we're in right now.
I do also think it's important to note that as states and local municipalities increasingly become the battleground for these types of mm-hmm. fights, you're going to see more money from the entrenched interests. You're going to see more of the top folks in the chambers of commerce fighting against these proposals, or Florida Power and Light fighting against the right of citizens to have an adequate value for rooftop solar. And it's very scary to see that type of influence being exerted, but it's better, I think, now that we're seeing some of that in the daylight.
Well, and Nick, you and I are both fans of the comics. I'm kind of the lame fan of comics, and then I mostly watch the TV and movies rather than reading the comic books. But one of the things we know is that when one side of any fight gets more powerful, the other side has to step up. And that's what I think we're going to see, is more of this organizing. I think Trump being in power will actually accelerate the anti-monopoly movement, because there's nothing like organizing against a common enemy. And what we're seeing in the Trump administration is advocate after advocate of more consolidated power, even though Trump may well, in some idiosyncratic ways, oppose them and fight against them. But right now, it's looking very bad, and I think it's going to result in a lot more organizing against consolidated power. I brought an issue that I'll just raise very quickly, and that's the issue of the FCC basically weighing in over in previous years, saying that local cities should have the right to be able to build their own networks. In 2016, the FCC lost its court fight with the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit determined that the FCC did not have the power to overrule state legislatures, which is a bittersweet decision in that we don't want to see preemption. However, this was an issue that would have restored local authority, so it was sad. But I think it's just a sign of what's to come. And so we don't have to talk about it at all. I just want to raise it quickly. But in the interest of time, I wanted to move on to reading suggestions. So we have hopefully people are going to have some days off, some time to spend with their family and that sort of thing over the next week or two. So any reading suggestions? Let's start with you, Olivia.
Something I read recently that has really stayed on my mind was a piece in the issue of The New Yorker that came out right after the election. And it was called Venezuela, a Failing State by William Finnegan. And most of what I know about what's happening in Venezuela right now comes from this article, and I haven't had a chance to read more widely. So I, you know, with that caveat that I'm getting a lot from one source. But it was particularly in that moment of the immediate aftermath of the election here, I found it really vital to look more deeply at what does a state look like when its political parties start prosecuting leaders of the other, when its free press breaks down. And it has, continued to stay on my mind in the weeks since.
Yeah, I just have to say, Venezuela, I think, has long been a hot mess, particularly for the American left, because there's a lot of things that Venezuela has historically done and Chavez did that we may look at and think, well, that's good for poor people. But the authoritarian tendencies, a lot of the things that we've seen coming out of there, and even people I've met from there who are people that were on the left there who have fled persecution. I think it's horrifying. And I really get frustrated with people who have a knee-jerk like defense of Venezuela, because I think Venezuela is a state that no one really wants to defend. And you can maybe learn some lessons from, but I haven't seen that article. I'll have to check it out. So what other things are we going to be encouraging people to read?
I recently picked up a book, Chris, called Trainwreck by an author named Sadie Doyle, and it's sort of a very smart, very sadly relevant these days cultural criticism of
wait,
how...
Wait. I know. Amy Schumer, LeBron James, they made a movie out of it. It's terrific. I loved it.
Totally different. I'm sorry to disappoint you. But Sadie Doyle sort of examines with a critical eye how we treat powerful women in our society and how we demonize them in many, many cases. So I found it to be a really helpful exercise in just critically thinking about things that we accept as normal and accept as just, you know, everyday pedestrian conversations and thoughts. And I think that embracing that mentality about more things that just occur around us every day is going to be very helpful as we sort of take on the fights and identify levers we have moving forward in the way that you talked about.
And I have to add a comment to everyone's thought. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's just something that I'm unable to keep my mouth shut. But I think, and this is something that I've talked with everyone about, I think one of the things in 2016 that I really recognized was more and more who we think of as being fully human and who is not.
Absolutely.
We're seeing this right now with the University of Minnesota, the football program, and this woman in this sexual assault. The details are unclear, but it's clear that a lot of people did not see her as fully human. It's clear that a lot of people did not see President Obama as fully American. And I think I really encourage people to try and look around and think, who do I think of as being fully human and who do I think of as being fully American and that sort of thing. I think it's important. And Nick, what do you recommend people read?
So I have two things, one that's relevant and one that may not be relevant for some folks. The first book that I'm in the middle of right now is called The Brethren by Bob Woodward and Scott Armstrong, and it's about the beginning of Chief Justice Warren Burger's time on the Supreme Court. And it is an absolutely fascinating, which may underlie that I'm a huge nerd, it's a fascinating look at the Supreme Court during a time where Nixon was getting impeached. There's a Watergate era. But they've also had a fundamental change in a lot of the jurisprudence. And while that may not sound interesting to folks, there's a lot of really great things and character studies of the different justices and the cases that they're taking on. And so it's definitely a good read. My second thing is something on theringer.com, which is Bill Simmons' site, called Simmons versus Gladwell, The Future of Football. And it's a very long piece talking about the big problems with the NFL ratings, the big problems with the NFL's structure, and gets to a lot of the heart of an argument about why the NFL is not necessarily the best institution to model yourself after if you're looking at successful sport franchises and successful ways to do business. And it's a good look, and it's a very intelligent conversation back and forth.
The Brethren is great. Maybe I'm a huge nerd also, but I think it's great.
Nerd solidarity.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not hard to call yourself a nerd in 2016. I feel like this is one of the things where, at this point, even jocks are like, I'm kind of nerdy too.
This is the best time to be a nerd. That's great. I mean, I really was born at the right time.
So I'm you know, as you know, I'm jockish, and I'm intrigued because I feel like the NFL seems like it's the most powerful league, and I'm guessing that, you know, some people think the writing's on the wall, whether it's from the brain injuries or just the declining ratings now and whatnot. So I'll be curious to see what happens next. But St. Paul is subsidizing a soccer stadium a few blocks from my home, so I'll be focusing on soccer in the starting in 2018, I think. Maybe paying a little less attention to football, especially as I'm raising my son. I'd love to see him play soccer. I played soccer more than football. And as I've been saying for a year, football is just too authoritarian. I don't want him to be in that mindset of the authoritarian, I feel like, whereas soccer players tend to be less authoritarian, I think.
I'll also say the NBA is rising right now. The NBA is rising right now. And something that's really interesting that I haven't seen, so I'll put a call out, is I want a comparative piece, a very long piece, because I'll read it, comparing the NFL and the NBA's structure and how they distribute power, because I think that's a very important way to look at it.
And I just, you know, talking about market power and that sort of thing, what's interesting to me is that these leagues have strong protections for workers. If you look at mixed martial arts, they have no union, and the amount of money that goes into mixed martial arts that goes back to the fighters who actually create all of the value is very little. And so I just, you know, for people who might be listening to this and they may not be into sports, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff. And I take just about everything that I do in my life comes from growing up playing team sports. So, you know, I don't want to just tack this on as something that's sort of like we're geeky and interested in sports, but I think it's important. Carly, you look like you've...
I was just going to say, I think it's important for everyone to consider the labor economy of college athletics also.
Right. You mean the I don't want to trivialize slavery, but it is really horrible what I think how little the people who produce all the value in college sports get, and that what we call non-revenue sports are facing elimination. Talking about gymnastics, men's wrestling, all kinds of sports that don't generate a lot of money are being cut. in programs across the nation as we try to give more money to football and basketball, which are sports that I love, frankly. But nonetheless, our universities should not just be generating money out of the most popular sports. There should be a place where kids can go and do gymnastics at a high level. And the University of Minnesota is a wonderful place for that. I hope it continues for a very long time. My recommendation is just an article that our colleague Stacey Mitchell had written for a book on antitrust from the Antitrust Institute. The article is Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business, and we'll have a link to it along with all these other articles and suggestions in the notes for the podcast. But I think it's really important that we not just talk about monopoly power in terms of the threat it has to raise our prices down the line and that sort of thing. And I thought Stacey's article was a really good example of, you know, just 15 or 20 pages on exactly what the threat is to democracy, what the threat is to innovation and that sort of thing. So highly recommend it. It's gotten really great reviews from people all over the place when it came out. Cory Doctorow did a big blurb on it. So really recommend people take a chance to a minute to read that.
You get extra brownie points for mentioning an article that one of our colleagues wrote. Yeah. You're making us all look bad.
Yeah,
Chris.
You didn't tell us that was the rule. Well,
my article is something Chris Mitchell wrote.
Yeah, unfortunately, it'd be hard to do that. I did not do much writing in 2016. Something in 2017 I aim to fix. So, but thank you. Thank you, everyone, for joining and listening. We hope you have a wonderful new year. And we'll be back with some Building Local Power discussions in 2017.
Thanks, Chris.
That was Olivia LaVecchia from the Community Scaled Economy Initiative, Carly Weinman from the Energy Democracy Initiative, Christopher Mitchell, Director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative, and Nick Stumo-Langer, the ILSR Communications Manager here at ILSR. They were revisiting some of this year's events and what that may mean for 2017 in local communities. This was episode number 8 of the Building Local Power podcast. As the year comes to a close, we hope you will consider our work at ILSR in your year-end giving. There are a few places where you can hear experts like Olivia, Carly, Chris, and Nick discuss the importance of local policy and find resources to use in your own community. ILSR has been doing it for more than 40 years, but we need your participation. Please visit ilsr.org and click on the donate button. Any amount will help. We encourage you to subscribe to this podcast and all of our other podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Never miss out on our original research by also subscribing to our monthly newsletter at ilsr.org. Thanks to Dysfunction Al for the music licensed through Creative Commons. The song is Funk Interlude. I'm Lisa Gonzalez from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Thanks again for listening to the Building Local Power podcast. Have a peaceful holiday season, and we'll see you again in 2017.